my mom kicked me out. Simple as that. It was pretty much like, you know, a teen coming into themselves and her not being able to deal and bear. So she just said, I'd rather have someone else deal with it and deal with the headache than me.
I can't file a missing person for 48 hours.
This is a minor.
She hasn't been home since 5 o'clock yesterday.
Any family problems, drugs, fighting?
No.
What's the name?
Gwen.
Edward Gwen Araujo.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Restraint on gay bishops and a new female chief strain U.S. Anglican relations. Queer youth contend with mean streets and funding cuts. And the life and death of a girl like Gwen. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 24th, 2006. Several Christian denominations have been debating Holy Scripture and homosexuality, and it's been rough going almost everywhere. The 2.3 million member U.S. Episcopal Church, part of the Global Anglican Communion, held its general convention in Columbus, Ohio this week, where it elected a pro-LGBT woman as the communion's first female presiding bishop and refused to issue an outright ban on ordaining openly queer bishops. The final resolution on the subject did not declare a complete moratorium, something the church's more conservative members and branches of the Anglican Communion in many other countries had demanded. Outgoing Episcopal Primate Frank Griswold offered a carefully worded motion committing the church to exercise restraint by not consenting to the consecration of any candidate for the episcopate whose manner of life presents a challenge to the wider church and will lead to further strains. His proposal passed in the 300-member House of Bishops on a show of hands and was approved by lopsided margins by both clergy and lay delegates in the more than 800-member House of Deputies.
The Anglican Communion, a loose-knit group of 38 national churches representing 77 million people around the world, has been in crisis since 2003. That's when the U.S. Episcopal Church ordained partnered openly gay New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson, and Canadian Anglicans began blessing same-gender marriages. Robinson told the convention that he is not an abomination in the eyes of God. I desperately want to preserve this communion, he said, but I can't do so at the expense of my own integrity and that of my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters in Christ. Newly elected presiding bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey of the Nevada Diocese supported Robinson's elevation to bishop in 2003. Shorey told a CNN reporter this week that she does not believe homosexuality is a sin. I believe that God creates us with different gifts, she said. Each one of us comes into this world with a different collection of things that challenge us and things that give us joy and allow us to bless the world around us. Some people come into this world with affections ordered toward other people of the same gender, and some people come into this world with affections directed at people of the other gender. No doubt exacerbating increasing divisions within the communion, Shorey flaunted her feminist credentials by preaching in her first sermon as presiding bishop, Mother Jesus gives birth to a new creation, and you and I are his children. If we're going to keep on growing into Christ images for the world around us, we're going to have to give up fear. Shorey will be installed to her 9-year term in a November 4th ceremony in Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral.
In the first major reaction by international Anglican primates soon after the convention ended, a dozen African archbishops suggested that they're preparing for a formal split. Addressing the U.S. Episcopal Church, the Council of Anglican Provinces of Africa, meeting in Uganda, issued a statement saying, "We have observed the commitment shown by your church to the full participation of people in same-gender sexual relationships in civic life, church life, and leadership. We have noted the many affirmations of this throughout the convention. As you know, our churches cannot reconcile this with the teaching on marriage set out in the Holy Scriptures and repeatedly affirmed throughout the Anglican Communion." They went on to offer a new home for conservative American Episcopalians upset by the direction of their church, a further signal that a split in the Anglican Communion may only be a matter of time. The Reverend Susan Russell, president of Integrity, an advocacy group for gay and lesbian Episcopalians, told the New York Times that we're being treated like bargaining chips in the game of Anglican politics.
mainline Protestant groups, including U.S. Methodists and the country's largest Lutheran branch, have struggled for decades over the traditional Christian condemnation of homosexual acts, even as gays and lesbians have pushed for full inclusion in their churches. The Presbyterian Church USA decided during its National Assembly in Birmingham, Alabama this week to allow openly gay clergy, lay elders, and deacons to work with local congregations. The measure, approved by a 298-221 vote, maintains a Presbyterian Church law that says clergy and lay elders and deacons must limit sexual relations to heterosexual marriage, but also says that restriction is not essential. That will allow local congregations and regional presbyteries in the 2.3 million member church to exercise some flexibility when choosing clergy and lay officers, including non-celibate lesbian or gay candidates. Conservative factions are threatening to leave the Presbyterian Church over the move. According to a report in Pink News, 13 evangelical groups immediately issued a statement saying the new edict had thrown our denomination into crisis and that it marks a profound deviation from biblical requirements, and we cannot accept support or tolerate it. The statement cryptically added, "We will take the steps necessary to be faithful to God."
The United Church of Christ announced this week that one of its regional units, the United Evangelical Church of Puerto Rico, has voted by a 3-to-1 margin to leave the denomination because of its liberal policies on homosexuality. The Reverend John Thomas, president of the 1.3 million member church, said that theological differences had increased during the past few years, especially regarding the membership and ministry of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Christians. The final straw apparently came when the United Church of Christ annual synod endorsed same-gender marriage last year. Prior to the Puerto Rico decision, the denomination reported that 49 U.S. congregations had quit over the marriage equality issue, though dissenters count at least 77.
Latvia's Christian Democratic Party has called homosexuals degenerate. So it's no surprise that for the seventh time, the country's parliament has rejected a measure to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination. However, President Vaira V.K. Freiberga vetoed the decision this week, saying there is a logical reason to enact such legislation. That may be because it was stipulated as a condition for membership when the country joined the European Union in May 2004. There's no indication yet as to how the Latvian parliament will respond to the presidential veto.
A ruling party lawmaker in Bermuda said this week that she'll try again to pass a lesbi-gay anti-bias bill a month after a similar measure failed in the British territory's parliament. Renee Webb of the Progressive Labour Party said her proposed amendment to the territory's Human Rights Act of 1981 is supported by some members of her party and the opposition United Bermuda Party. She says she hopes to get a new vote on the issue in November. Lawmakers defeated Webb's bill in a voice vote last month, sparking a protest at the Capitol by some 300 demonstrators who criticized Parliament for not even debating the proposal. The amendment, which would outlaw discrimination based on sexual orientation, has drawn the most vocal opposition from religious groups. Premier Alex Scott has called it unnecessary, saying the Human Rights Act already covers all people in Bermuda. But he said he was open to a possible court ruling that gays and lesbians are not protected by the law. Dale Butler, Bermuda's Minister for Human Rights, said he would vote for the amendment if it comes up again, but didn't think it would pass because members of Parliament are afraid of voter backlash.
Members of a parliamentary committee in Jamaica have made it clear they will not decriminalize homosexuality in the proposed new Charter of Rights. But that didn't stop the National AIDS Committee from arguing before the committee this week that people most at risk of contracting HIV are forced underground by laws banning sex between consenting adult men. Homophobia and its pervasive anti-queer harassment and violence is deeply rooted in Jamaican culture. Those attitudes seem to be at least tacitly encouraged by the island nation's major religious institutions, which have staunchly opposed decriminalization.
And finally, tensions continue to fester over plans for the International World Pride Festival and Parade in Jerusalem this August. Leading Jewish, Christian, and Muslim clerics have repeatedly and vocally denounced it. Ibrahim Sarsour, an Arab-Israeli member of the Knesset, Israel's parliament, said this week that this attack is more venomous than the Zionist attack to make Jerusalem Jewish, and that if gays will dare approach Temple Mount during the Pride Parade, they will do so over our dead bodies. And while it's a trademark of holier-than-thou religious conservatives to express concern for children, another lawmaker in Israel has concerns about queer children. An international LGBT youth group is scheduled to visit the Knesset during World Pride to see how Israel's government works. But Otniel Schneller, an MK of the ruling Kadima Party, wants to prevent that. He sent a letter to Knesset Speaker Dalia Itzik this week, charging that a visit by the youth group would turn the building into Sodom and Gomorrah. Itzik promptly rejected Schneller's demand. A fellow Kadima Party MK, Ronit Tarosh, later told Israel Radio that, "These are children who could be mine or yours. I am absolutely stunned. Who are we talking about here? We're talking about human beings. If they want to visit me in the Knesset, they are more than welcome."
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 24th, 2006, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lunn.
And I'm John Beaupre.
A battling civil rights super lawyer brings the story of a murdered trans teen to the small screen with a view towards social change later in the program. Tens of thousands of runaway and throwaway children and teenagers are fending for themselves and sleeping on the streets in cities around the world. In the U.S., as many as half of them may identify as lesbian, gay, bi, or trans. Most escaped or were expelled from homophobic families. And many find that the same prejudice stands in the way of the basic community services they desperately need. Programs for LGBT homeless youth are on the mayor's chopping block in New York City. But these vulnerable kids are not fighting alone, as Leanne Stanky of Free Speech Radio News reports.
San Francisco, L.A., New York. These large cities, which have a reputation for tolerance, are often a destination for young lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth. Many teens arrive with a few belongings tossed into a bag after their parents discover their sexual identity. Bridget, a lesbian-identified, formerly homeless youth, was asked to leave her home when she was a preteen, when her mother found her kissing another young woman.
My mom kicked me out. Simple as that. It was pretty much like, you know, a teen coming into themselves and her not being able to deal and bear. So she just said, I'd rather have someone else deal with it and deal with the headache than me.
Carl Siciliano is the director of the Ali Forney Center, a small emergency housing program for LGBT youth aged 16 to 24. He says that Bridget's story is common.
Not only do they have no money and no food, but they have no wallets and no identification. A real common story that I hear is that the parents find out that the kid is gay, and that night they're told to put their belongings in a garbage bag and hit the streets.
For Bridget, homelessness necessitated that she enter the underground economy.
Survival of the fittest, I had a what you call hustle. You know, do all kinds of things. You know, get little rinky-dinky jobs, manipulate people, sometimes even escort. You know, you don't know, you're not old enough to have fit survival skills to be able to budget and things of that nature. You learn that as you get older. I'm 11, 13 years old, out on my own. You use what you know, which isn't very much at that age.
Bridget's story is echoed around the country. There are an estimated 7,000 homeless youth sleeping on the streets in New York and as many as 10,000 in Los Angeles County. A disproportionate number of these young people identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. New York City Councilperson Lou Fidler is fighting to provide safe housing and queer-friendly services for this underrepresented group.
When you analyze the number of kids who are sleeping on the street of the city of New York, estimates run as high as 50%. Coming from that community.
According to Fidler, chair of the Youth Services Committee, statistics regarding who is sleeping in shelter beds indicate that LGBT youth are afraid to stay at large shelters like Covenant House, where homophobia is rampant.
The single provider of shelter beds for runaway and homeless youth in the city of New York only estimates that 3% of their population is LGBT. Which indicates that they're clearly missing the mark or that the LGBT community doesn't feel comfortable at that provider.
Kate Barnhart is the manager of Sylvia's Place, a 10-bed emergency facility in Midtown Manhattan serving homeless LGBT youth. Many young people find their way to Sylvia's Place after a disturbing stay at Covenant House.
Well, a lot of the young people who come here come in with horror stories from Covenant House of being verbally or physically harassed by both peers and staff. I've had one young man who showed up here black and blue from head to toe because he had been beaten up, and the staff had not intervened.
Bridget agrees. She experienced both physical and verbal harassment during her brief stay at Covenant House.
When I've had people sit there and like threaten to throw blow dryers in the shower when I was taking a shower, I've had people put urine and bleach in my shampoo. I've had people rip up my clothes. I've had people sit there and like wait for me to come home from work, and like, because I would usually come home like around 10, 11 o'clock, wait for me outside and like throw cigarettes at me.
Many queer youths say they'd rather spend the night on the street than go back to Covenant House, which is why Councilperson Fiddler is lobbying for the city to continue providing for this population. At present, the mayor has eliminated $1.2 million that was earmarked for homeless LGBT youth from his proposed 2007 budget. Fiddler would like to see these funds restored, and he's also seeking an additional $1.2 million for services provided by centers like Allie Fournay. These services are effective but costly, which is why Fiddler and his colleagues are asking not only to restore the funding, but to add an increase. The budget is being evaluated now and is expected to be finalized on July 1st. I'm Leanne Stanky in New York.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming program features and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each upcoming program. Just email tworadio@aol.com to get one or both of these messages delivered to your email inbox. And be assured that we don't share, sell, or otherwise provide your email address or anything else about you to anyone, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates and or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com.
If I should die tonight, you know I won't die blue. I've had so much love in my life. I've had you. Dark clouds unfold me, and there's pain. Sometimes there's pain all in my side. Oh, but a love like ours could never be denied. Oh, we had to fight for it. Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
A Girl Like Me, the Gwen Araujo story, recently began a run on North America's Lifetime cable channel. This Way Out's Steve Pride says it's a very special movie, starring relative newcomer J.D. Pardo as Gwen and Academy Award-winning actress Mercedes Rule as her mother, Sylvia.
Is everything all right?
Yeah, I still have some money left.
No, I mean with Eddie.
With Eddie?
I asked why he wore the dress.
God, is this about last night?
He said he wants to be a girl.
He's 7 years old, Angie. For God's sake, he's a kid. All kids do silly things like that.
Warming up now. I think he needs help.
With what? With baseball?
This isn't about sports.
Look, don't let anyone take you out. Eddie is the best thing that ever happened to me.
I'm not saying he's bad. I'm saying he's different.
The story of Gwen Araujo's life and murder was brought to the screen by attorney Gloria Allred, who took the project to Lifetime and served as the film's executive producer. As Sylvia Araujo's attorney during the two murder trials, it's a story and family she cares about.
Gwen was a young person who felt that she was a female trapped in a man's body, and she didn't want to live a lie. She wanted to be able to be honest about who she perceived herself to be.
Will you talk to me?
You don't want to talk.
I'm asking.
But you don't. I see you working so hard to make us like everybody else.
No, to make you happy.
I hate my life, Mom. I hate it every single day.
Don't say that.
But there's something wrong with me.
There is nothing wrong with you.
You see? I can't hide it no matter how hard I try. It's like everybody knows, so I'm not going to hide anymore just to be what you want to make me.
It's not what I want to make you. God made you.
If God made me, then God's a sadist.
She expressed her feelings to her family, and her mom and her family accepted that she self-identified as a woman, and they supported her. They continued to love her through her dressing as a female and through her beginning to call herself Gwen instead of Eddie Arahu Jr., which was the name given to her when she was born. She was searching for love and acceptance, as many teenagers are. Unfortunately, that search and her life ended on October 3rd, 2002. That night, at the age of 17, she put on a stylish denim skirt. She went to a party just blocks away from her home, and then she never returned. Her mother was very, very worried about her because it was unlike her not to call, not to return.
I can't file a missing person for 48 hours.
This is a minor.
She hasn't been home since 5 o'clock yesterday.
Any family problems, drugs, fighting?
No.
What's the name?
Eddie.
Edward Gwen Arajo.
Male or female?
Female.
She was born male.
Look, with all due respect, we get these cases, kids like this, they have trouble, they run away.
She didn't run away.
Ultimately, it was found that she had been brutally killed by individuals who decided that she would pay the ultimate price for what they believed was her deception. According to the testimony of one of those individuals, when he and three other young men at the party learned to a certainty that the pretty girl with whom two of them had recently had sex had male genitalia, then Gwen was slapped, kneed, choked, and hit with a can and a skillet, and a rope was tied around her neck. She was strangled, and then the young men took her body and drove her 150 miles away to the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains and buried her in a shallow grave. The funeral was attended by over 1,000 people from the Latino working class community, and also media from around the country came to cover it. The church was filled to overflowing. I remember also that there were students from the local high school who had just completed giving the play about Matthew Shepard. They came in angels' outfits, and they formed an aisle so that the coffin carried by the family and others could pass through. And of course, their wings from the angel costumes blocked some of the protesters who came to the funeral. And that was a beautiful sight that I'll never forget. I also remember there were police and SWAT teams on the rooftops at the church and the surrounding area because of threats and protests. Gwen's mother, Sylvia, honored Gwen by having her dressed the way she would have wanted, in a skirt, a blouse, and makeup.
We're here today to say goodbye to my daughter, Gwen. She was just a girl, but I think that she lived life more than most of us. We didn't always accept her, but she was very patient, and in time she taught us how. She used to say, I love you too much. I know that she loved us more than we deserved.
Later, Sylvia had her child's name legally changed to Gwen. Gwen had a right to be who she was. She had no duty to live a lie to conform to someone else's standards. Unfortunately, the honesty and courage that she displayed cost her her life. The district attorney charged the men not only with murder, but also with a hate crime. The killer's strategy during the first trial, which began in May 2004, was thought by many to be a so-called gay panic or trans panic defense. Previously, two of the defendants had had sex with her, allegedly thinking at the time that they were having anal sex with a girl. Defense attorneys claimed that their clients went into an alcohol and drug-fueled, quote, shock and panic, end quote, when they realized that Gwen had the anatomy of a male. The jury deliberation in the first trial lasted almost 3 weeks. Then on June 22, 2004, the jury announced that they were deadlocked, but not because the gay or trans panic argument worked. The DA indicated that the entire jury voted in favor of a murder conviction for the three men, but they were deadlocked over whether it was first or second degree murder, and the DA immediately announced that the case would be tried again. The good news was that the jury didn't buy the gay or trans panic argument. They felt it was murder. They refused to come back with a verdict of manslaughter or acquittal. In the retrial of the three young men that was conducted in 2005, there was 3 months of testimony after which the jury found two of the men guilty of second-degree murder in the death of Gwen Araujo. Their names were Michael William Magidson and Jose Antonio Merrill. The jury deadlocked on the third defendant, Jason Casares, and didn't find the hate crime allegation to be true as to any of the defendants. On December 16, 2005, Jason Casares entered a plea of no contest to voluntary manslaughter.
Attorney, author, and civil rights activist Gloria Allred knows that one film will not change the world. For that, she needs you.
Each of us in our own way, Steve, if we decide, or I should say when we decide, that we want to make the world a better place, can do that. I begin my book, Fight Back and Win, My 30-Year Fight Against Injustice, with a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. You must be the change you wish to see in the world. And that's what I believe.
This has been a conversation with Gloria Allred, Sylvia Araujo's attorney, and the executive producer of A Girl Like Me, The Gwen Araujo Story. Currently, in the California legislature, is AB 1160, the Gwen Araujo Justice for Victims Act, which would amend jury instructions to state that the use of so-called panic defenses is inconsistent with California's comprehensive hate crimes law. For more information on A Girl Like Me and other films of LGBT interest, drop by prideonscreen.com. For more information on Gwen Araujo, pick up Gloria Allred's new book, Fight Back and Win, My 30-Year Fight Against Injustice and How You Can Win Your Own Battles. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
So grim reaper, here is the harvest. Oh, it's rich, rich and full and ripe. And you know I'm going down easy. If I should die tonight, I say I'm going down easy. If I should die tonight,
thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner, Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Leon Stanky, and Steve Pride contributed program material with a special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Sapphire performed some of the music you heard from her album Ain't Gonna Hush, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can now listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. Click on the Features link on their front page. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to our website to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special LGBT history, music, and culture CD thank you gifts. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CJSR Edmonton, Alberta, KHSU Arcata, California, Trans FM Broward County, Florida, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.